Hello, this is Mark Greyer, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the October 16th issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Okay, let's have the first article. How FEMA is forcing disaster-struck towns to fend for themselves. President Trump has said he wants to eventually shift the burden of disaster relief and recovery onto states. It's already happening. Life is inching back to normal in the town of Cave City, 7 months after a tornado slammed into its corner of northeastern Arkansas. The only grocery store is about to reopen. Crews are starting to dig the foundation for a rebuilt funeral home. But the town, like so many others facing daunting recoveries from recent disasters, has had to go it alone, Mayor Jonas Anderson said. The Trump administration denied Cave City's request for Federal Emergency Management Agency funding to help it recover. Mr. Anderson was forced to forge ahead anyway, racking up a bill of about $300,000 he said could end up eating 15% of the small town's annual budget. Some of the nearly 2,000 residents have gotten federal help. FEMA agreed to cover repairs to more than 50 homes damaged or destroyed when 165-mile-an-hour winds struck in March. The state pledged relief money, too, but Mr. Anderson said Cave City is carrying more of the burden of recovery than expected. We're making a really good recovery, not because of some big FEMA reimbursement we got, but in spite of not getting it, Mr. Anderson said. People here are super resilient. This could be the future for more communities across the country, based on President Trump's version of emergency management in the United States, one that would transfer responsibility for disaster recovery from the federal government to the states and all but the largest catastrophes. For many places, it is already the reality. FEMA has been delaying disaster declarations and aid payments to communities, adding new hurdles to access some grant funds, and cutting off the flow of money intended to boost resilience and prevent future disasters from causing so much damage. Emergency managers and elected officials across the country are adjusting to a system in which they can no longer count on the sort of disaster aid they typically expect from FEMA, which was established in 1979 to coordinate and professionalize disaster response. They are figuring out how to prepare for future disasters without key FEMA grants, raising private funds to replace federal aid and turning to state governments to beef up their preparations. In some places, volunteer disaster recovery squads have sprung up. In an email statement, the FEMA spokesman, Daniel Legruz, said that the agency has held back some disaster relief funding, saving it for the future. For example, a monthly report on the agency's spending this summer showed it withheld $11 billion for projects tied to a coronavirus pandemic disaster declaration that states had expected to receive by September 30th. Agency officials said those payments are not canceled, but rather deferred into the new fiscal year to ensure the solvency of the government fund used to pay for disaster aid. Under President Trump's leadership, FEMA remains committed to supporting disaster survivors, Mr. Legruz wrote. He said the agency is managing disaster funding in a way that prioritizes immediate needs and long-term recovery efforts. Still, the consequences of such delays could be that communities find themselves less prepared when disaster does strike, critics say. They're making good on their promise to shift the burden onto the states without giving the states any runway to prepare for that, said Sarah Leibowitz, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, who tracks disaster recovery spending across the country. Slower than expected hurricane and wildfire seasons have meant few recent tests of the evolving emergency response system, allowing FEMA to stretch its disaster relief fund further than it might otherwise. The fund had been forecast to run out of money by now, but as the end of September, it was projected to contain more than $2 billion, down from a routine $202.5 billion infusion from Congress in March. Since January, Mr. Trump has approved 32 federal disaster declarations, which make available a variety of federal aid programs to communities and individuals. That's far fewer than an average of more than 60 declarations per year from fiscal years 2015 through 2024, according to the Congressional Research Service. Mr. Trump has rejected nearly a dozen state requests for FEMA aid so far this year, on par with the numbers of rejections during his first administration, as well as President Joe Biden's term, according to FEMA data. A steady backlog of pending disaster aid requests has persisted this year, sitting at a dozen as of Tuesday. Under previous administrations, there have rarely been more than a handful of outstanding requests at any given time. Normally, Congress would appropriate tens of billions of dollars to refill the disaster aid fund at this time of year. Amid a government shutdown stretching into its third week, there has been little discussion of disaster funding on Capitol Hill. A bipartisan group of members is supporting a House bill that would make FEMA a cabinet-level agency, removing it from the Homeland Security Department while streamlining its payment process and speeding up agency investments in disaster resilience around the country. Representative Frank Pallone, a Democrat from New Jersey, said a strong FEMA is important for coordinating among states that may have different capabilities when it comes to handling crisis. These disasters tend to be multi-state, Mr. Pallone said. If you have to do everything yourself, it's not going to work because you don't have the expertise. Proponents of a trimmed-down FEMA, on the other hand, argue that too much federal aid can prevent communities from investing in their own preparedness. State and local governments are more closely attuned to communities' needs and should be equipped to handle the most common and predictable types of disasters, said Dominic Lett, a budget policy analyst at the Cato Institute, a right-leaning research organization. But in places still recovering from historic disasters, slow and unpredictable support from FEMA demonstrates the limits of those ideas. In western North Carolina, a year after Hurricane Helene, and 4 years after an earlier bout of devastating flooding from the remnants of Tropical Storm Fred, the town of Canton is still operating out of trailers and waiting for federal money it expected for a new town hall and police station, Mayor Zeb Smathers said. We should not have to count on recovery like it's raffle money, Mr. Smathers said. It should be streamlined, efficient, dependable. It's not. Okay, next article. Trump hosts dinner for wealthy donors to White House ballroom. The president lauded dozens of executives and business people for the tremendous amounts of money they have pledged for his project, which has prompted ethical concerns. President Trump hosted dozens of wealthy spenders for a dinner on Wednesday in exchange for what he called the tremendous amounts of money they agreed to donate to construct a $200 million ballroom addition to the White House, a project that has sparked concerns from ethics watchdogs. We have a lot of legends in the room tonight, and that's why we're here to celebrate you, because you gave, Mr. Trump said in the East Room. They wanted to have a ballroom, and it never happened because they didn't have a real estate person. More than three dozen corporate executives and wealthy business people attended the dinner, where Mr. Trump expressed gratitude for their opening their checkbooks for his long-desired state ballroom. Representatives from companies including Amazon, Apple, Google, Microsoft, and Lockheed Martin were in attendance. So were wealthy supporters of Mr. Trump, like Harold Hamm, the billionaire oil and gas executive who bankrolled Mr. Trump's 2024 campaign and stands to benefit from his energy policies. Tyler and Cameron Winklevoss, who run the crypto exchange Gemini and have contributed hundreds of thousands of dollars to a pro-Trump PAC called Mega Inc., were also here. The building of a 90,000 square foot ballroom has raised a number of questions about potential conflicts of interest. White House officials have said Mr. Trump and other donors would pay for the renovations, but have provided few specific details. Richard Painter, who served as the chief ethics lawyer in the White House counsel's office under President George W. Bush, said in an interview that Mr. Trump's dinner for corporate executives shows what the ballroom is really all about: pay to play. Getting an invitation to the White House to a dinner because they're contributing to the construction of this project, Mr. Painter said. This is payment for access, not just to the grounds of the White House, but access to the President of the United States. Mr. Trump and his aides have maintained that the additional space to host foreign dignitaries and other guests of the White House is urgently needed. In the past, the White House has often hosted large crowds under a tent on the South Lawn. The American presidents need to be able to showcase our country, Mr. Trump said on Wednesday night. In a meandering speech that shifted from details of the ballroom, bulletproof windows, and a capacity of 999 people among them, to a description of his foreign policy agenda, Mr. Trump told the audience that he expected the project to be completed under budget. He also suggested that some attendees had offered to pay more than $20 million for the ballroom. So many of you have been really, really generous, Mr. Trump said. I mean, a couple of you. I was sitting here and saying, sir, would $25 million be appropriate? They said, I'll take it. Mr. Trump also showed corporate executive models of a new arch that he planned for near Arlington National Cemetery. Mr. Trump's speech touted on a range of topics, including statues of Confederate generals and his strikes on vessels near the coast of Venezuela. He pivoted to talk about his administration's military strikes on boats in the Caribbean. The administration has said those boats were transporting drugs, but has provided a few details about who was on the vessels at the time of the strikes and given relatively thin legal justifications for its campaign. In fact, nobody wants to go fishing anymore, Mr. Trump said, prompting laughter. No one wants to do anything near the water. They might have a beautiful boat, and they might as well get rid of their boat because they're very nervous. Mr. Trump also acknowledged the arc of his relationship with many of the people in the room. Towards the end of his speech, he noted that some of the business leaders there opposed him in the past, but have rushed to support him as he amassed power. It's amazing the way a victory can change the minds of some people, Mr. Trump said. This was the guest list, as provided by the White House official. Altria Group, Amazon, Apple, Booz Allen, Caterpillar, Coinbase Global, Comcast, Hard Rock International, Google, HP, Lockheed Martin, Meta Platforms, Micron Technology, Microsoft, Next Extra Energy, Palantir Technologies, Ripple, Reynolds American, T-Mobile. Well, you get the point. Okay, next article. A military celebration sparks another Newsom-Trump feud. Governor Gavin Newsom had feared that the ceremony would send missiles over Interstate 5, but the Marines later said that its live fire would be contained. The U.S. Marine Corps said on Wednesday that its large military celebration planned this weekend at Camp Pendleton in Southern California would not close any public highway or transportation routes, hours after Governor Newsom of California raised fears of missiles soaring over Interstate 5. The Marine Corps said in a statement that it would conduct live fire activities, but that its event would take place at a beach west of the freeway. Earlier in the day, Mr. Newsom had raised alarms about the ceremony and bemoaned what he described as the administration's lack of planning with local authorities. The episode was the latest example of how communications have broken down between Mr. Newsom and the Trump administration over all manner of activities, including the ceremony to honor the 250th anniversary of the Marine Corps. Camp Pendleton, near the city of Oceanside between San Diego and Los Angeles, is the Marine Corps' largest training facility on the West Coast. It includes a portion of undeveloped coastline and sits close to Interstate 5, a heavily traveled corridor. The White House previously announced that the Saturday event would feature amphibious assault demonstrations and that Vice President J.D. Vance and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth were scheduled to attend. But Mr. Newsom's office said that 3 days before the celebration, California officials still had not received detailed information about the planned activities. Mr. Newsom's office raised alarms. His spokesman, Izzy Gardon, said that it had learned the military planned to use ordnance as part of the celebration, possibly launching it from the sea, over Interstate 5 and onto some part of the base's 125,000 acres. Mr. Gardon said on Wednesday that the governor had begun coordinating with state transportation officials and the California Highway Patrol to potentially close the freeway as a public safety measure for parts of this weekend, a major shutdown of California's primary north-south interstate. We are preparing for this potential scenario while we await clearer instructions from anyone in the federal government, Mr. Gardon said. Shortly before 10 p.m. Pacific time on Wednesday, the Marines issued a statement explaining what it had in store. They said they would host a live fire amphibious capabilities demonstration at Red Beach, which is west of the freeway. They also said the exercise would occur on approved training ranges and comport with established safety protocols without the need to close public roads. All air, surface, and ground movements are scripted and rehearsed in accordance with standard operating procedures and established safety checklists, the Marines said. A related celebration is scheduled to take place afterward at Del Mar Beach, less than 10 miles south. Mr. Gardon was not immediately available for comment after the Marines issued their statement. The Camp Pendleton event, with Mr. Vance and Mr. Hegseth, both of whom served in the military, is scheduled to fall on the same day that anti-Trump activists have planned a slew of quote-unquote No Kings protests around the country. In June, No Kings protests took place at the same time President Trump held a military parade in Washington. The military event will be recorded by the White House production office to show in a national broadcast on November 9th. Okay, moving on, next article. Truckers are struggling. Trump's new tariff could make things worse. A 25% levy on heavy-duty trucks and parts is set to take effect next month. Companies have few details on the policy. Companies involved in transporting goods into and around the United States are bracing for another tariff, this time on trucks. President Trump is planning to impose a 25% tariff on medium and heavy-duty trucks and truck parts on November 1st. The Trump administration has released almost no details, creating confusion among truck makers and truckers and prompting much lobbying to try to shape the final policy. If few exemptions are granted, industry and analysts say the tariff could raise the cost of manufacturing trucks and repairing old ones. Mr. Trump is imposing the tariff under a national security provision known as Section 232 that he has also used in tax imports of steel, aluminum, cars, medical devices, and lumber. We need our truckers to be financially healthy and strong for many reasons, but above all else, the national security purposes, Mr. Trump wrote on Truth Social last month. The tariff was originally meant to take effect on October 1st. Prior Trump tariffs have already had an impact on trucking, sometimes negative. Steel and aluminum tariffs have pushed up the cost of the metals for truck makers like Daimler Truck, which makes Freightliner rigs. Daimler said in its most recent quarterly earnings report that uncertainties resulting from U.S. tariff policy had contributed to a steep decline in sales. Trucking companies were buying fewer vehicles even before Mr. Trump's latest trade war, and low shipping fees have been hurting their bottom lines. Tariffs on truck parts would be particularly painful because trucking companies buy parts to extend the life of their vehicles, said Satish Jindal, president of SJ Consulting Group, which advises transport and logistical companies. Mr. Jindal said he expects tougher times to continue for trucking companies. Their margins are going to suffer, which is not good for the companies or for the shippers, he said. In announcing the tariffs, Mr. Trump said he was protecting American truck makers from unfair outside competition. Around two-fifths of the trucks sold in the United States are imported, with most of them from Mexico, said Jason Miller, a supply chain professor at Michigan State University. PACCAR, which makes Peterbilt trucks, would not have much trouble moving the small portion it produces abroad to domestic plants, said Jonathan Secreta, an analyst who covers the company for CFRA, an investment research firm. The upside is they're able to shift production into the U.S., where they already have a massive manufacturing footprint, Mr. Secreta said. Ken Hastings, a PACCAR spokesman, did not respond when asked whether the company was planning to move production out of Mexico and Canada, where it had plants. He said PACCAR hoped that the truck tariffs would negate the current disadvantage that those of us who proudly manufacture trucks in the U.S. currently face. But trucks made in the United States may contain significant amounts of foreign parts, which may be hit by the tariff. Ford Motors chief executive Jim Farley told CNBC last month that his company made all of its heavy-duty trucks in the United States, but he added, for the vehicles we do build in the United States, there are a lot of parts we don't make in the U.S. The Volvo Group, which produces Mack trucks, makes all its trucks in the United States, said John Meese, a company spokesman. Like everyone in our industry, we have a global supply chain, so we do import parts, he said. We don't yet know what the November 1st tariffs will mean for parts imports by U.S. manufacturers. Okay, the next article, staying in the topic of trade. The small company in Europe caught in the big trade war between the U.S. and China. Nexperia, a computer chip maker headquartered in the Netherlands, was taken over by the Dutch government after pressure from officials in Washington. Late last month, Washington's intensified contest with Beijing over control over tech supply chains spilled over in the Netherlands. The Dutch government, under pressure from U.S. officials, took control of the Chinese-owned chipmaker Nexperia. Nexperia, which is headquartered in the Netherlands, but owned by the Chinese company WingTech, operates a complex global spanning supply chain typical of chip manufacturing. The company designs older types of chips used in cars and electronics and employs thousands of people across Europe, the United States, and Asia. Its factories press thin slabs of silicon in Britain and Germany and assemble the test chips in China, the Philippines, and Malaysia. On September 30th, the Dutch government declared that company decisions would now be determined by its Minister of Economic Affairs, Vincent Karemans. Hours earlier, the United States had expanded the scope of a trade blacklist that meant Nexperia would face strict controls on its operations because its owner, WingTech, was already on the list. In a statement on Sunday revealing its action, the Dutch government said it moved to prevent Nexperia's products from becoming unavailable in an emergency, but documents published in an Amsterdam court on Tuesday showed that months earlier, U.S. officials had pressured the Dutch government about the company's ownership. The United States Department of Commerce placed trade restrictions on WingTech last December. In June, American officials told the Dutch Ministry of Foreign Affairs that Nexperia could be next, unless the company replaces its Chinese chief executive. The fact that the company's CEO is still the same Chinese owner is problematic, the American officials said, according to court documents. Nexperia is just one of the companies caught in the middle of a battle for control of the global chip industry, as Washington and Beijing have claimed sweeping authority to control supply chains for semiconductors and materials, critical input for everything from cars to artificial intelligence systems. As the United States and China flex their influence over supply chains, other countries will seek to unwind Chinese ownership of key technology assets on national security grounds, said Riva Gujon, a director of Radium Group, a research firm. Nexperia was an obvious target. The Chinese government has spent billions on the goal of boosting its domestic industries, and Chinese companies like the state-affiliated investors that sold Nexperia to WingTech also ramped up accusations of foreign firms that make chips and other technologies. While Chinese chip makers have struggled to make the cutting-edge chips that power advanced AI systems, they make an increasingly large share of older types of chips. Some officials in the United States and Europe have grown concerned that China could come to dominate the market for those chips. Even though they are less advanced, they are used in cars and a wide array of machinery and appliances. Now, many governments want those supply chains back under their control, she said. There have been very big concerns and regrets, Ms. Kajon said. All these governments are very uncomfortable with that and would like to see these assets back in their possession. Days after the Dutch government took control of Nexperia, China's Ministry of Commerce issued a notice barring Nexperia's Chinese units from exporting some products, the company said in a statement on Tuesday. The company is seeking an exemption from the Chinese controls and has deployed all available resources to that end, the statement said. China's Ministry of Commerce has not publicly commented on its restrictions on Nexperia. He Yongjiban, a spokeswoman for the ministry, said at a briefing on Thursday that Washington's expanded controls had seriously undermined the security and stability of the global industrial supply chain. The Dutch government's takeover of Nexperia was a clear example of how the American rule harms the legitimate rights and interests of Chinese companies, Ms. He said. Beijing exerted its influence over another part of global technology chain last week when it announced when it announced sweeping controls on critical materials that are used in ships, cars, missiles, and more. The new rules closely resembled American technology controls that Chinese officials have long criticized. The Chinese government also targeted an industry that it sees as crucial for its own security and economic growth, shipping. On Tuesday, Beijing imposed sanctions on American subsidiaries of the South Korean shipping company Hanwha, accusing them of supporting and assisting the United States with its shipbuilding industry. The order took effect immediately and bars Chinese companies and individuals from doing business with the Hanwha units. Ms. Gaozhong and Rhodium Group said governments would continue to look for ways to regain control of critical technology manufacturing as the contest for influence escalates between Washington and Beijing. This has been building for a long time, she said. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Okay, on to the next article. Cuomo looks for a debate night spark in hopes of catching Mamdani. Andrew Cuomo, the former governor of New York, intends to attack Zohran Mamdani's qualifications and leftist ideology. He will be under fire, too. Former Governor Andrew Cuomo needs no reminder about the stakes of a New York City mayoral debate. Back in June, his long-shot challenger, Zohran Mamdani, landed a series of blows in a pair of debates that helped pierce the aura of inevitability around Mr. Cuomo and fuel the upstart, remarkable Democratic primary upset. Now, with the November 4th general election closing in, it is the former governor who is hoping their televised rematch Thursday night can provide the spark he desperately needs to ignite a comeback of his own. It will be no easy task. A poll released last week showed that Mr. Mamdani, a 33-year-old state assemblyman, is sitting on a 13-point lead, and as he showed in the primary, he is an agile debater able to distill ambitious policy plans and parry attacks. But Mr. Cuomo, who is running on a third-party ballot line, intends to step onto the stage at Rockefeller Center and give Mr. Mamdani everything he has. Hanging in the balance is not only the leadership and direction of the nation's largest city, but the fate of one of New York's most storied Democratic dynasties. I think his positions are nonsensical. I think his ideology is farcical. I think his experience and qualifications are non-existent, Mr. Cuomo, 67, said Wednesday, previewing his debate plans. That's what I'm going to say. Some fellow Democrats and political operatives following the race said they could see a path, albeit an extremely narrow one, back for Mr. Cuomo if he can begin to bend the narrative of the race on Thursday and reinforce it in the final debate next week. Scott Stringer, who debated both men as a candidate during the primary, said that the expectations game that hurt Mr. Cuomo when he was the front runner might now work to his benefit with Mr. Mamdani in the lead. The debate is going to be a key indicator of whether going forward this gets to be competitive, said Mr. Stringer, who has not endorsed a candidate in the general election. But, he added, Mr. Cuomo also has to early on give voters a reason to vote for him proactively. Mr. Mamdani, a Democrat socialist with a thin resume, does have vulnerabilities. The same poll that showed him with a wide lead last week found that a majority of New York voters are not yet behind him. A plurality of poll respondents said he does not have the kind of experience that they would like to see in a mayor. Mr. Cuomo intends to replay many of the attacks he has leveled for months, that Mr. Mamdani is too far left, harbors disdain for the police, who Mr. Mamdani once said should be defunded, and would not be able to stand toe-to-toe with President Trump or deliver on plans to alleviate the city's cost-of-living crisis. Deep-pocketed donors who have dangled the possibility of putting tens of millions of dollars behind the late anti-Mamdani super PAC blitz will be among those watching closely. Their spending decisions could hinge on Mr. Cuomo's success rattling Mr. Mamdani. When you are behind, you can't afford to miss these opportunities, said Howard Wolfson, a political advisor for former Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who, after spending $8 million for Mr. Cuomo in the primary, is now sitting on the sidelines. There will still be more chances after Thursday, Mr. Wolfson said, but as Yogi Berra used to say, it's starting to get late early. Allies, said Mr. Cuomo, will also try to portray the contest as a one-on-one race between Mr. Mamdani, actively ignoring Curtis Sliwa, the Republican nominee, who will be on stage with them. Mr. Sliwa's voluble style may make that difficult. To win in November, Mr. Cuomo will have to convince conservative voters that he is the only viable alternative to Mr. Mamdani and that their votes for Mr. Sliwa would be wasted. Mr. Mamdani, his task is simpler. Do no harm. But he signaled on Wednesday that he planned to go on offense, too. Mr. Cuomo has his own serious vulnerabilities that Mr. Mamdani attacked during the primary debates. Polls show New Yorkers find him unlikable and unethical 4 years after he resigned as governor in a sexual harassment scandal. He denied wrongdoing. Mr. Mamdani said he would seek to keep the discussion focused on the needs of actual New Yorkers and previewed a plan to attack Mr. Cuomo's record as governor on transportation and housing issues that he argues helped make the city less affordable. I look forward to being on that stage with the architect of that affordability crisis, Andrew Cuomo, Mr. Mamdani said. Mr. Sliwa, for his part, suggested that despite their differences, he planned to lump Mr. Mamdani and Mr. Cuomo together as Democrats cut from similar cloth on issues like bail. Crime is a very important issue, and both Andrew Cuomo and Mamdani share the same views, Mr. Sliwa said. They are protecting the violent, the perps. I am protecting the victims. Some allies fretted during the June debates that Mr. Cuomo's answers were muddled at times and that he failed to hit Mr. Mamdani hard enough. But the more aggressive tack he has adopted recently does not come without risks. Showing Mr. Mamdani to be unprepared and inexperienced would help Mr. Cuomo, but it could also reinforce his reputation for being abrasive. That danger was on display on Wednesday at an event Mr. Cuomo held in Chinatown with opponents of a plan to close the jail complex at Rikers Island and relocate its occupants to neighborhoods like theirs. He relentlessly critiqued Mr. Mamdani as a far-left extremist who would put the city at risk. As he filled out of a room of supporters, as he filed out of a room of supporters, Mr. Cuomo was stalked by a woman who liked his plan to keep Rikers open and thanked him for his service as governor, but warned that his caustic tone toward Mr. Mamdani bothered her. It would serve you well, I think, if you could be more diplomatic instead of being judgmental, said the woman, Lauren Leong, who added that she was leaning toward supporting Mr. Cuomo. We have too many who are name-calling, disparaging. Don't hear the other side, she added. I just hope you don't come across like that. Okay, next article from the opinion section. This is an article by Jessica Gross. Kennedy's comments on circumcision are only going to confuse and shame parents. About a week ago, I joked to someone that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was going to say that clouds cause autism. He'd been quiet for a week or two, which meant he would be plucking something new out of the sky. It turns out that I chose the wrong C word. On Thursday, Kennedy, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, said in a cabinet meeting, there's two studies that show children who are circumcised early have doubled the rate of autism. It's highly likely because they're given Tylenol. Was he trying to persuade parents to avoid circumcision, Tylenol, or both? It's really anyone's guess, though it's worth noting that the Children's Health Defense, the organization started by Kennedy, has videos on its website discouraging new parents from hepatitis B vaccines and circumcision for their newborns, suggesting that it's all part of the same anti-establishment soup. Scientists who research autism have pointed out that the studies that Kennedy appears to be referring to about male circumcision are small and observational, that babies may not even be given acetaminophen after the procedure, and that more recent studies with better methodologies show no association between circumcision and short or long-term adverse psychological issues. Kennedy added that none of this is positive, but that any people who take acetaminophen during pregnancy, unless they have to, are irresponsible. As I previously wrote, there's no good evidence that most pregnant women are misusing acetaminophen, and any link between that and autism is far from proven. Sometimes I wonder if it's useful for me to get into the wacky statements Kennedy makes, because he makes so many of them, and I worry that I'm only amplifying his incompetent and inaccurate messages. But I have come to the conclusion that it's necessary because his public statements have so much power and reach. The day after the Trump administration pushed the link between Tylenol and autism, KFF, a nonpartisan health research organization, polled Americans about the claim. It found most adults, including majorities across many demographics, express uncertainty, saying the unproven claim is either probably true or probably false. Belief in this claim is closely tied to partisanship, with most Republicans, including over half of Republican women, saying it is either probably or definitely true. It seems clear that what Kennedy says, no matter how distantly tethered to scientific consensus, is successful at driving the public health conversation. Even as his statements are debunked by the most experienced researchers and disbelieved by many Americans, every time he mentions a fringe, unproven theory, it gains a firmer foothold as a measure of undeserved legitimacy. Circumcision is an instructive example because it epitomizes the Kennedy method of undermining public health expertise. Whether this is conscious or not, he seizes on hot-button issues that already have entrenched and aggressive internet partisanship. Excuse me. Uses quasi-scientific language and bolsters his case using minor cherry-picked studies. As a result, he muddies the water and creates more guilt and confusion among new parents who are already inundated with confusing information online. Let me say up front that on the issue of circumcision, I am Switzerland. As a mother of girls, I haven't faced this choice. While there are real health benefits to the procedure, like a reduced risk of some sexually transmitted infections and a lower incidence of urinary conditions, the American Academy of Pediatrics stops short of a universal recommendation. That's because the issue is complex, and as the group explains, parents ultimately should decide whether circumcision is in the best interest of their male child. They will need to weigh medical information in the context of their own religious, ethical, and cultural beliefs and practices. This seems reasonable, and caring parents, who should be adequately informed about the risks and benefits, can disagree on whether the procedure is right for their child. This is not an issue like measles vaccinations in the United States, for which there is an abundance of evidence for a universal recommendation, and there's no reliable way outside of vaccination to prevent the spread of the disease. But there is no agree or to disagree on the internet. Very loud anti-circumcision partisans have been flooding the comments of articles and social media posts about the procedure for over a decade, long before Kennedy blundered into the issue. In 2013, Slate's Matt Joseph Stern described how self-proclaimed intactivists went on the offensive whenever circumcision was discussed online, with a combination of untrue and exaggerated claims. Inactivists pummeled the Amazon rankings of a book about the history of AIDS that mentioned circumcision as a proven preventive measure. Check any internet message board and you'll find the same ideas peddled as unimpeachable fact. Circumcision is amputation, a brutally cruel and despicable form of abuse. It damages penises and violates human rights. And it irrevocably, undeniably ruins male sexuality for life. Which brings me back to Kennedy's bizarre statements, which also included a description of a woman as having a baby in her placenta, an automatically impossible situation. Parents who are trying to make an informed decision about whether to circumcise their child are probably more confused now than they were last week. And parents who circumcise their children have another issue to worry and feel guilty about, autism, that probably never occurred to them. Perhaps by bringing circumcision into the chat, Kennedy is trying to distract us from an ongoing measles outbreak that has required hundreds of unvaccinated grade schoolers to quarantine, or from the chaos at their Centers of Disease Control and Prevention, where just in the past week, the Trump administration fired hundreds of workers and then rehired them, some of them, because our president and his appointees don't seem to know how their own organizations function. Or maybe Kennedy's just totally unqualified for the job, and like many of Trump's cabinet members, was selected to undermine the public's faith in the establishment even further. All right, next article. Delta and United are leaving other airlines behind. Delta Airlines and United Airlines have accounted for most of the industry's profits since 2022. Their appeal to wealthy travelers could become a liability if the economy weakens. Airlines in the United States seem to be separating into two groups. Delta Airlines and United Airlines make lots of money. And then there's everybody else. Those two airlines have pulled ahead of the pack in recent years after making a few big bets. They expanded loyalty programs and leaned into selling more first and business class seats. And they operate lots of international flights. That has paid off handsomely. Delta and United have generated most of the industry's profits since 2022. And some experts believe their lead is only expanding. This is kind of the industry's paradigm now, said Tom Fitzgerald, an airline industry analyst for the investment bank TD Cowen. I think the divergence is set to become more and more stark every year. Last week, Delta said it had earned more than $1.4 billion from July to September, up 11% from the same period a year earlier. United said on Wednesday that it had earned $949 million in the third quarter. Both airlines have benefited substantially from increased revenue from loyalty programs and the sale of premium seats. Of course, every business strategy has some risk, and Delta and United could struggle if other airlines figure out more effective ways to compete with them or if the economy weakens in ways that hit affluent consumers particularly hard. Delta and United began putting their strategies in place years ago. After mergers in 2008 and 2010, they assembled fleets of jets suited to many uses, added premium seats to those planes, upgraded technology throughout the business, and revamped their frequent flyer programs. The airlines also added more routes and established partnerships with other airlines, extending their global reach. Those changes have given them new sources of revenue and made Delta and United more appealing to corporate executives and affluent travelers. The companies also benefit from dominance at airports serving prosperous urban areas. Delta controls more than 70% of flights at airports serving Atlanta, Detroit, Minneapolis, and Salt Lake City, not to mention its substantial presence in Boston, Seattle, and Kennedy International and LaGuardia airports in New York, according to Cirium, an aviation data firm. United controls a majority of flights at airports serving Denver, Houston, New York, Washington, and San Francisco. It's supply and demand. If you can control the supply, then you really can set pricing, said Kevin Healy, a senior advisor at Campbell Hill, an aviation consulting firm, and a former airline executive. American Airlines is similar to Delta and United. It has global reach and is dominant at several major airports, but it has not reported the same big profits. Aviation experts say that it's because American of Fort Worth has limited access to the same lucrative markets. The airline has not invested as much in premium seats and made changes that frustrated some corporate customers. American also carries a big debt. American declined to comment ahead of announcing its financial results next week, but the airline is investing in lounges and premium seats and making other changes to attract wealthier customers and improve its performance. Sales of premium seats have been a particular source of strength for Delta and United. A healthy stock market and the retirement of affluent baby boomers have helped to sustain demand for the expensive seats those airlines sell. What's changed over the last 10 or 15 years, the premium products used to be loss leaders, and now they're highest margin products. That's really the headline, said Glenn Hausstein, Delta's president, told analysts and reporters on a call last week. Delta says most of its revenue now comes from households that earn at least $100,000 a year. Mr. Hausstein also said that in some cases, leisure travelers paying high fares had squeezed out business travelers, typically the most sought-after customers because their employers pay for their trips. Delta expects premium revenue from expensive seats, credit cards, and other sources to exceed that from the main cabin by 2027, reversing a long trend. United, too, has capitalized well on rising premium demand. Loyalty programs have also become a huge source of profit. Starting about a decade ago, Delta and United and other airlines changed their frequent flyer programs to reward customers based on how much they spent, not how far they flew. The airlines also added lounges and other perks to make loyalty programs more appealing. The airlines now bring in billions of dollars each year from those programs, much of it in profit. In the third quarter alone, Delta received about $2 billion from American Express, which runs its co-branded credit card. That was 12% more than it earned the year prior. United said its loyalty revenue in the third quarter was up about 9% from the same period last year. We've invested in customers at every price point, the airline's chief executive, Scott Kirby, said in a news conference on Wednesday. Those investments over almost a decade, combined with great service from our people, have allowed United to win and retain brand loyal customers, leading to economic resilience. As Delta and United generated consistent profits in recent years, carriers that specialized in offering lower price tickets lost their edge. Budget airlines once excelled at operating at relatively low costs, but labor, airport access, and other parts of the business have become more expensive in recent years, eroding that advantage. That, along with a glut of domestic seats, has squeezed the discount carriers. What about economy travelers? Now, the low-fare airlines are emulating Delta and United. Spirit Airlines, now in its second bankruptcy in a year, and Frontier, another budget carrier, have introduced premium-like offerings. Even Southwest Airlines, which for decades eschewed the approaches used by the other big carriers, has been remaking itself more in their mold. Because premium demands appear to be here to stay, analysts at J.P. Morgan said in a note last week, they now believe that the advantage airlines like Delta and United have over lower cost rivals that offer only economic seats is both permanent and irreversible. Of course, no airline is unsaleable, and the industry is rife with companies that went from roaring success to penury. The thing that's going to ruin it for Delta and American, the thing that is going to ruin it for Delta and United is American, said Nicholas Owens, an analyst of Morningstar, the financial services company. If American spent $1 billion and sent all their planes to the shop and redid the seating arrangement, would they not have the same outcome? Economic conditions can pose a threat too. A downturn, particularly one that sends stock prices tumbling or that hits wealthy customers particularly hard, could greatly reduce demand for premium seats and make travelers more price conscious. Shortages of planes, workers, and air traffic controllers have limited competition among airlines in recent years. But Airbus and Boeing are trying to produce planes more quickly, and the Federal Aviation Commission is working to hire more controllers. If it becomes easier for airlines to buy new planes and fly more routes, other carriers might find it easier to compete with Delta and United. They have pulled ahead and they are performing well, and they've done things that have made it better, Mr. Owens said. But that doesn't mean they've changed the laws of physics. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the October 16th issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Your reader today has been Mark Ryer. Thank you so much for listening.